I'm Tom Brew. You have turned on the news. Turn on the News is a daily look at radio art, media art, radio news, media news, and more. Go to free103.9.org to find out what transmission art is and why it has its own daily radio show. And newsroom.free103.9.org has links to international sources of radio art news, radio news, and more. Tonight, we are going to talk CISPA, CISPA, and look at the House vote on CISPA. I guess, spoiler alert, we will jump ahead to the ending first. The U.S. House of Representatives voted 248 to 168 late Thursday, April 26th, to pass the cybersecurity legislation known as CISPA. Some increasingly more liberal Republicans like Representative Chris Gibson in upstate New York voted against the bill. And the bill passed after some last-minute secret negotiations that made it much, much worse. We'll get to all that in just a moment. First, we're going to let Free Speech Radio News dial us back a few hours for the vote and explain just what CISPA is.
On Capitol Hill today, the House of Representatives took up the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA. The bill's broad language allows private companies to share consumers' personal data with the government and one another. While the bill's Democrat and Republican supporters say it's a crucial step to protect the country's databases from foreign and domestic cyber attacks, its path to becoming law has challenges. The White House has threatened a veto, and civil liberties advocates are mobilizing to defeat it. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Privacy and civil liberties advocates say the cybersecurity bill would break down the walls between companies with questionable privacy records, including Google and Facebook, and agencies with a history of privacy violations, including the National Security Administration. But CISPA supporters on both sides of the aisle have countered these concerns, saying the information sharing is voluntary, not required. But lawyer Michelle Richardson with the American Civil Liberties Union says that doesn't address the problem.
The government isn't forcing these companies to turn over the information, and the companies have a choice. But the important thing is that the customers don't. The customers are not going to be able to opt out of this program and prevent their information being shared with the NSA and other military agencies.
Unlike the successful protests against the anti-piracy bills SOPA and PIPA earlier this year, the campaign against CISPA does not have the backing of industry. In fact, most major tech and telecom companies, including Facebook, IBM, AT&T, Microsoft, and Verizon, are actively backing the bill and lobbying for its passage. Josh Levy with the online advocacy group Free Press explained why.
It lets them off the hook for something that they're already doing and participating in. So the National Security Agency is already asking Facebook and other companies for information on its users. It's not actually legal. It lives in a legal gray area. So what this would do is it would indemnify companies like Facebook from any legal challenges for giving up our private information. It would make that behavior officially legal.
CISPA places no limits on the kind of data that can be shared and would override existing anti-wiretapping laws, companies' individual privacy rules, and the Electronic Privacy Act. Any kind of personal data, from bank, education, and medical records to the content of emails, would be up for grabs. The bill would also block any Freedom of Information Act requests from consumers trying to find out who is sharing their personal data with whom. In a speech on the House floor on Thursday, Colorado Democrat Jared Polis raised further concerns about the bill.
CISPA allows information sharing, quote, for the protection of national security, end quote. A broad and undefined category that can include practically everything under the sun. Is a Tea Party activist a threat to national security? Is a communist activist a threat to national security? The danger that this can be used for political oppression and to stifle political speech is very real.
On Wednesday, the president wrote to Congress saying he strongly opposes CISPA, citing a lack of oversight and accountability measures and threatening to veto the bill. Seeking to address these and other concerns, the House took up a long list of amendments to CISPA on Thursday. One provision up for debate strips the immunity CISPA gives companies for improperly sharing personal data. Another limits what kind of data can be shared, and another prohibits the government from saving or using the data for anything other than cybersecurity reasons. Without these safeguards, Josh Levy with Free Press says CISPA will have a chilling effect on free expression on the internet.
It would make it harder for us to communicate online without fear of being spied on. And that would result in us communicating less. This incredible freedom and this incredible opportunity that we have to connect with each other would be chilled because we wouldn't know who's watching. We wouldn't know what the effect of that spying would have on us.
Despite the opposition to CISPA, the bill has strong support from many Democrats and Republicans and is likely to pass the House. To drum up support during Thursday's debate, Texas Republican Mac Thornberry described the consequences of not passing CISPA and leaving the country vulnerable to a cyber attack.
The electricity grid going down, a whole city being poisoned by its water supply, chemical plants releasing emissions that it doesn't intend to release, real death potentially and destruction can occur all because of things going on the internet.
But some civil liberties advocates, including the ACLU's Richardson, say these kinds of what-ifs should not scare Congress into signing away important protections.
And those sorts of issues have not materialized yet. It's unclear if they ever will, but they certainly do not merit a response where the NSA is turned loose on the domestic civilian internet.
The House will vote on CISPA and its amendments on Friday, but with the threat of a White House veto and the Senate companion bills still stuck in committee, CISPA has a difficult road ahead to become a law. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
I'm Tom. Are you listening to Turn On the News? And we are talking about CISPA tonight. And that was Alice Olstein with Free Speech Radio News with her report before the House vote tonight. But since then, the U.S. House of Representatives voted tonight 248 to 168 late Thursday, April 26th, to approve the CISPA Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. Now, Cory Doctorow at Boing Boing reports that at the last minute, there was a surprise amendment added to the bill to make it much, much worse for civil libertarians and folks that don't want to be spied upon in the United States. I guess he's quoting TechDirt's Leah Beeden. I guess that's the main the source. And I was trying to get that link before, and it's not coming up. Maybe because it's being overwhelmed. But here's the quote from the story. Previously, CISPA allowed the government to use information for cybersecurity or national security purposes. Those purposes have not been limited or removed. Instead, three more valid uses have been added: investigation and prosecution of cybersecurity crime, protection of individuals, and protection of children. Cybersecurity crime is defined as any crime involving network disruption or hacking, plus any violation of the CFAA. Basically, this means CISPA can no longer be called a cybersecurity bill at all. The government would be able to search information it collects under CISPA for the purposes of investigating American citizens with complete immunity from all private protections as long as they can claim someone committed a, quote, cybersecurity crime, unquote. Basically, it says the Fourth Amendment does not apply online at all. Moreover, the government could do whatever it wants with the data as long as it can claim that someone was in danger of bodily harm or that children were somehow threatened, again, notwithstanding absolutely any other law that would normally limit the government's power. You can go to boingboing.net for that link, and that was from TechDirt's Lee Beeden. So TechDirt is the place for the original source for that. All right, enough about CISPA. We'll hear Melissa Dubin and Aaron Davison's song, Every Spy Has Their Numbers. This is using radio spy number stations from the Cold War. And then Free Press will have us give us media minutes in just a moment on Turn on the News.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing about online video this week, and it's clear that some members have a lot to learn. Technology is rapidly creating the potential for new content and new conduits from producer to viewer. But some senators are having trouble thinking outside of the traditional TV box. In an exchange with Senator Jim DeMint, Barry Diller of IAC, an internet company with more than 50 brands including Ask.com, Match.com, and Vimeo, tried to explain about his new venture, Aereo, a platform that uses tiny antennas to receive broadcast signals over the internet. DeMint started the questioning by asking Diller, who at one time headed Paramount Pictures, Fox Broadcasting, and USA Broadcasting, to think back to his days as a broadcaster and react to Aereo from that perspective.
If I was in the broadcast business, I would do what every broadcaster has done since the beginning of broadcasting, which is to protect their arena and do anything to prevent anyone else from getting into it. Mm-hmm. But I would also recognize that the part of being a broadcaster was receiving a free license. Mm-hmm. And in return, you programmed in the public interest and convenience. And core to that was that if you had a finger in the air or an antenna or whatever, you could receive a signal without anybody taking a toll or doing anything to prevent you from receiving that signal directly.
DeMint pressed the issue of reselling content.
So do you see yourself as selling network subscriptions, in effect, or do you see yourself as reselling content?
We're not reselling anything. What we have is a technological platform.
But it's a network, in effect.
No, it's not a network.
People can subscribe to your network to receive content.
Well, you have this antenna, and it's one-to-one. Mm-hmm. It is not a network. It is a platform simply for you to receive over the internet broadcast signals that are free and to record them and use them on any device you like.
Well, the broadcasters have licensed with the producers of the content to broadcast that. But you are going to, in effect, capture that and resell it without a license.
No, we're not. Sorry.
You're not?
Senator, we're not reselling anything.
The exchange went on until a frustrated DeMint moved away from the subject. Diller also told the panel that an open Internet is crucial to competition, that America's inferior broadband infrastructure was posing problems for innovation, and that it was time to rewrite the Telecommunications Act of 1996.
48 Native American radio stations serve the nation's tribal communities, with many of them broadcasting in the local tribal language. As a platform for information and storytelling, radio has been a major asset to Indian country. Tracy Morris is the director of operations with the nonprofit group Native Public Media.
Radio is a huge thing in Indian country, not only because it is accessible, but because it's a natural medium, I think, for Native folks. We're storytellers anyway. Our stories are oral, so having the radio has been fantastic.
Native Public Media wants to help Native radio stations capitalize on this asset. With the help of the Institute of American Indian Arts, the group has created an innovative journalism course on using radio to tell stories in tribal languages. The course, called Digital Journalism and Storytelling, is the first of its kind, with curriculum by Natives for Natives.
It's really designed to take our radio folks and teach them about convergence of media onto the Internet and to enable them to be able to tell stories in multitude of mediums.
11 participants representing Native American radio stations across the country will gather in Santa Fe for the course. Morris said that Native radio stations don't have enough content producers. The course is designed to build skills and capacity so that tribal communities can tell their own stories instead of relying on the mainstream media.
As a former educator, I've taught, and I know when that light bulb goes on and people see what they can do and see the power that this gives them. So I'm really excited to see each of these folks take this knowledge and see how they apply it. It's a power, and I want to see that storytelling power come to life.
Each participant will produce a 3 to 5 minute story and receive 3 college credits. Morris says she's thrilled by the possibilities that this course can offer to tribal stations and Native journalists.
It also provides the diversity of voices that we don't hear in radio these days and even on the Internet. The direct access to this medium is a great equalizer in Indian country. Anybody can produce content. Anybody. And we're going to show them how easy it is to do so.
To find out more, visit nativepublicmedia.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
We begin overseas, where Australian Rupert Murdoch, known as Yahoo, extremely serious, finds himself still in a spot of trouble in Great Britain simply because several of his newspapers hacked the phones of celebrities, politicians, a 13-year-old murder victim, and the relatives of some killed in action British soldiers, and allegedly bribed Scotland Yard detectives to help with the cover-up. I could go on, but I know many of you are probably eating in the next 24 hours. And but of course, Mr. Murdoch has already answered for those crimes against decency last July.
Mr. Murdoch, do you accept that ultimately you are responsible for this whole fiasco?
No.
Okay! Well, that's a wrap, people. Clear the chamber. The House of Commons Subcommission on the Regulation of Muffin Nooks vis-a-vis its crannies has the room at 14 o'clock. I said good day. Come on, Murdoch. If you're not responsible, who is responsible?
You're not responsible. Who is responsible?
The people that I trusted to run it, and then maybe the people they trusted.
My God! This scandal goes all the way to the bottom. The buck stops! But now Parliament has opened a second inquiry. This time into whether Rupert Murdoch used his media entities to improperly influence the British government. And once again, Murdoch had his unaccountability moment.
I want to put it to bed once and for all that that is a complete myth.
So what's the myth, Mr. Murdoch?
That I used the influence of the Sun or the supposed political power to get favorable treatment.
Now, when you say that you never used influence to get favorable treatment is a myth, do you mean that as in it's a fanciful way of explaining things that are hard to explain, or that it's a story about how grotesquely powerful beings assume various forms to f*** mortals? By the way, that's Zeus. That's Zeus coming down in the form. Zeus coming down in the form of a swan to have sex with a mortal woman. Story is apparently how peaches ended up with fuzz. I have mythologies. Come on, Rupert Murdoch, don't on my chest and tell me it's Vegemite. According to various reports, Murdoch had been a frequent visitor and visitee of British prime ministers wishing to thank him for his support for a long, long time. While coincidentally, in 1981, 2 years into Margaret Thatcher's first term, Murdoch was allowed to circumvent monopoly rules to buy two more papers. In 1990, those same rules were waived again for his B-Sky B satellite TV purchase. In 1998, Murdoch asked Prime Minister Blair to squash a European Competition Commission investigation that would further delay another of his broadcast projects. In 2003, Blair allegedly added a last-minute clause to a bill that allowed newspaper owners to also purchase terrestrial television stations. The clause is referred to, for reasons that are apparently unclear to the chairman of News Corp, as the Murdoch Clause. Of course, I do notice that there's no David Cameron involvement. Perhaps the current prime minister alone was able to withstand the Australians' innocent charms.
Mr. Cameron flying out to Santorini in your yacht.
You have no recollection at all of that, do you?
It's coming back to me vaguely. Actually, I checked it with my daughter because he was being flown, I believe, by my son-in-law's plane on his way to holiday in Turkey, and he did stop in Santorini, and she says that I, in fact, met him on her boat. But it doesn't matter, there were a couple of boats to go.
I mean, the size of these boats, mate, I mean, they're enormous, these boats. I can't be expected to know the whereabouts of every prime minister in my fleet. By the way, not for nothing, not only did Cameron meet with Murdoch, Cameron had to go to him. And his only way in and out of the meeting? Murdoch's son-in-law's plane. Over in the States, we're not allowed to give congresspeople t-shirts and hats, and our country's corrupted.
This is Spy vs. Spy, Combustible Edison.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Murray. You've been listening to Turn on the News, 3.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, and more. Go to FREE103POINT9.org to find out more about just what transmission art is and why it has a daily news show.